Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Today's guest is Antoinette Daniel. Antoinette is the founder of Just Helpers, an award-winning ethical cleaning agency in London that champions fair pay, dignity, and justice in an industry that's notorious for exploitation. A self-described accidental campaigner, she's built a business that not only provides excellent cleaning, but also advocates for systemic change across the sector. Antoinette's journey has been one of resilience, vision, and holding the line on her values, from growing her company to surviving collapse during COVID to rebuilding with integrity. She speaks and mentors widely on leadership, justice, and the power of doing business differently. Her one-line bio: clean boss, fairness fan, accidental campaigner, and a lover of a good cup of coffee and slice of cake. Welcome.
Amen. She's already got her good cup of coffee in front of her, so we're halfway there.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome. It's so lovely to be here with you, Dan and Alice.
Brill. So before we jump into today's core question, can you tell us a little bit about your career?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So this is why I'm an accidental businesswoman. I am a trained PE teacher. I wanted to do that since the age of 13. So qualified, got a job, ended up in my dream school, the school that I thought I'd retire in. And the going was good. Like, the trajectory was amazing. I was online for deputy headship, all the things, loving life, loving my job. But then I started to hear about human trafficking. And for around 3 years, I just tried to dodge it, really. I just thought, somebody else's problem. I'm doing my thing. I'm saving my corner of the world. But it just followed me. And so eventually I just started to ask, well, what can a PE teacher from Croydon do about human trafficking? And I landed on probably education, probably get on the ground. I think India at that time was the highest source country. So get on the ground, do some education about bright light syndrome in London. So I quit my job. I sold my house. I trained to be a missionary of Christians and faith background. And in those 2 years where I really kind of de-teacherized, de-culturized, thought about working cross-culturally, like not exporting culture, the Bible, but the message of whatever I was trying to bring. A wise woman said to me that to make any systemic change, you need to do three things. You need to get public support on the ground. People on the ground need to understand where their money's going and what the impact of that is. You need actual support for the individuals that have been impacted and affected, and make sure the infrastructure works well for them. And then you need legislative change. And so all of that in the melting pot, I kind of tried to set off to India and couldn't. It just, for whatever reason, it just didn't work. And so ironically, I ended up volunteering in the UK, interning for anti-trafficking charities, and then eventually a part-time paid role, almost back on my doorstep about 4 years later, and worked with an anti-trafficking charity aligned with the Salvation Army, who'd got the big tender for safe housing at the time. So I did that 3 years, built a grassroots charity up, worked myself out of a role, embedded that role into local council, all sorts of grotty things in those 3 years. We had to pose as punters and call brothels to try and work out if there were indicators of trafficking. So training retired gentlemen on just sexual acts that they had probably never, ever heard of in their life. So some dark days there. So a lot of grassroots initiatives around anti-trafficking. But when I got this part-time role in the Borough of Merton, London Borough of Merton, house money was pretty much running out, and I realised I need to pay the bills. So I thought, I'll have a side hustle. I think I'd signed on at the job centre for the first time in my life, mid-30s, really didn't love that whole experience, and just thought, I've got to work, like, whatever it takes, I've got to work until I find this dream job. So I thought about cleaning and proposed it at a dinner party. I was lovely mulled wine, you know, nibbles, Christmas dinner party, middle class people. And it was almost like the music stopped. Cleaning. Well, you know, it's flexible. I can be in and out. No one will talent swap me. I don't have to manage anyone. That was the big thing. And I can do it around this anti-trafficking job. So interestingly, at that dinner party, a friend just said, well, that's really bizarre because last night somebody asked me, do you know a cleaner? Do you want me to introduce you? So that's how the cleaning started. It was a side hustle initially, and it's just grown. It's grown into this mammoth beast. It's my main event, and we've been going now for 13 years.
Wow. And it's just amazing to hear that you stepped out of what was a, you know, you were on that linear trajectory, right, of what you thought was passion into something that is truly passionate. With so many issues facing the world right now, what was it about trafficking that really concerned you to the point that you were willing to put everything aside and go for it?
That's such a great question, Alice, because I hear quite a lot of issues that go on around me, and still trafficking is the one that gets me in the gut. I think, so I'm a looked after child, and there's something about having freedom and agency over your own body. Gosh, it's making me feel quite emotional, really. Freedom and agency around your own body. And I think it's just a core value that's really important to me. So to hear of initially women and children, that was the children's story that really got me. Hearing children as young as 2 being trafficked for sex. It's horrendous. And I don't know why, all the issues in the world, that is the one that grips my soul, but it does. It literally paralyzed me eventually. I'd just be balled up in a fetal position in the middle of the night, sobbing as you're hearing story on story. I guess it links to slavery as well. So, you know, all those connections, that's kind of the first big narrative that I heard, this connection between the transatlantic slave trade and the modern day slave trade. And so there's kind of ancestral things that are all meshed into that as well.
I mean, it's interesting because just as an objective observer of your of your story, there is for me a very clear through line between being a PE teacher, where it is very much around having agency over your physical state, the human trafficking aspect, and then also the cleaning part, again, about having agency over the environment that you are, that you occupy every day. Do you see those parallels across?
Don't know if I ever have. And so I'm going to put that in my pipe and smoke it, because it's a current question I'm asking. Like, what's the arc story? Because I think that there is one. And I feel like I'm still the same person doing the same thing in every space, which is seeing people's potential enabling them to thrive, enabling them to be liberated and thrive. And as a PE teacher, it was very much that there is something for everyone. I want every child in this school to leave this school being passionate about one sport. I want every child to feel seen and heard through the medium of sport, and participation would rocket in every school that I'd be in. The same in all the anti-trafficking charities. So I've always ended up with that volunteer role. How do I take all these random people that want to do something and corral them into something that's going to give them purpose and life, but enable the charity? And I guess, so the cleaning, I see the human first. I think that's...
Yeah. That's a really good segue into our question, but I still have one more question about your background. So I think what is also quite remarkable for me is that you go from the position of a teacher, which is an authoritative position, right? So you've earned your right to have some authority in the environment you work in, whereas cleaning is a very different type of position within society, right? It is, I mean, and this might just be me projecting my own idea, but it is, I would assume, for a lot of people, something that is a very humble role to occupy. Yeah. Did you find that transition difficult?
The transition for me personally, yes, it was a really interesting 6 months as I had to redefine who am I. And I really battled with it. I mean, starting from that dinner party conversation where people looked at me with horror, my family, like, but you know, we've sacrificed for education and the house, and now you're a cleaner. And that was the tone of voice pretty much across the board. And I really had to come to my own place in this, because I, first of all, I'd introduce myself as an ex-teacher, but I just persuaded myself to say, no, I'm a cleaner, full stop, no explanation. And I would kind of force people to engage with that. And again, it made me understand that as we grew and as I started to take people on, it's the human first. Yes, your profession is in the cleaning industry, but you are a valid human being. You're contributing massively to society. And I think things like COVID showed us that. The people that held the country
unsung
together.
Unsung heroes, right? Yes. But it's so fascinating that you say, but I was a teacher. And we do that. We overcompensate with the butts.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a fascinating approach, you know.
So that definitely is one of our rally cries with any clients that are considering coming on board with us. We're looking for people that understand that this is a human to human interaction.
Yeah.
And absolutely. We're not really interested in anything else. Mm-hmm. So we have been known to let clients go in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
But if you can't respect the person in your home that is enabling you to be free and do the things that you're best shaped to do, then, you know, what does that say about you?
Absolutely. So on to the core question. What happens when we put humanity at the heart of work?
Oh, I think I want to preface all of that by saying it's messy. It's a messy, glorious way of being. But when we start to put humanity at work, I think that we enable each other to thrive. When you start to have those honest conversations about, one, I want to know who you are, what makes you tick, and then how can we get the best out of each other? I think that we see really spectacular things happening in the workplace. You know, it's been 13 years and it's been a roller coaster and I've seen many different things, but I would say pre-COVID, everyone in the company would come to work, turn up to work, thinking that they were coming to work in the family business. That's kind of how it felt. We were in it together. We call our cleaning team helpers. Every helper had access to me. I'd be on the ground doing spot checks. From the very first interview, my very first question really is, what did you want to be when you were six? Like, who are you really? Because no one at the age of four dreams of being a cleaning professional. I think that that's a reality. But actually, there are people, as they go through into that profession, realize this could be a job for life. But I'm always interested in what's at your core, because if it's cleaning, like, then how can we enable that? But if it's something else, how can we enable that too? Or how can we give a nod to the skills and the experience and the breadth that you bring into this current role? And if it's a transitionary role, how can we help you to thrive in this role, but help you to flourish at the other end as you step in to the next phase? So there, you know, how our interview questions are designed to, our entire process is designed to really understand the individual and to help them understand the company, the team that they're stepping into. So there are peer interviews that happen within that, enabling people to have really candid conversations without management anywhere near it, so that they can ask, you know, what are this lot really like? I've read their blurb, but how much of this is true and how much isn't? And we really encourage that. We encourage our peers to just say, that's a private conversation between you guys. But the big picture that we want back is, are they one of us? Like, are they going to embody our values and our culture and pass that on to the next person? We're not asking for the granular details in those private conversations, but we do want to make sure that we provided a forum for that to happen. And then we have a face-to-face with management team, and then we have a training day with another colleague. And again, all those three things are designed to help them build relationships. More than anything, it's so that they know another person that works in this agency, because everybody's working remotely, that might live in their region, that they can call on for help and build relationships with that way. And so before COVID, and it's kind of accidental, because I'd never owned a business. I never thought I would own a business. So it just organically happened. I'm just always thinking, well, how would I like to be treated on the ground? Okay, well, let's see if that works. And I think the lesson I've learned since COVID is it's not necessarily about how I would like to be treated. It's how the individual would like to be treated and needs to be treated. And so that's the transition that we're in now. I've waffled a lot.
It's really interesting. I think you make a really, really good point there, because I think sometimes organizations are under the impression that in order to be more human first, they need to accommodate all of God's green earth of humanity in order to accommodate for that. And I think it's actually a two-way street, right? As you were saying, it's not just about asking people, what do they want to be? How do they want to work? Things like that, and then accommodating for that, but also figuring out whether they're a good fit for the organization as well. So having that kind of conversation, I think, is really essential. It's not, it is, you do have some agency as an organization over who you bring in, but equally, if you all work together towards defining what humanity looks like in that particular context, and actually create a better environment for everyone to thrive, as you were saying. So, yeah, really interesting.
I only had this chat yesterday because I interviewed somebody, and past 5 years, I've hired exec level people. So they've had maybe 1 or 2 years experience and about to go into the next, 2 to 3 years. And everyone, this is my next 5 to 10 year job. And I'm like, that's really, really, it might be, but I'm going to say 99% chance it won't be, because this generation now, that they want to move around, experience different cultures, different workplaces. I was like, look at it as a, what do you want out of the next 2 years for your career? And we'll create that for you. Don't then think that you said, this is my next 10 year job, and then come up to me 18 months later with a 4 week resignation period and be like, I'm moving on. Actually, let's just see this as a, what do you want to get? What do you want to learn? And then we'll get you ready for that next role. If it is a, that's it. But if you are in it for the long haul, let's also develop that out too. But it's about having that honest chat. Yeah. And I think as the employee, sometimes we're like, I couldn't possibly go to somebody and say, I'm only going to be here for 2 years. That might be negative. Mm. It's understanding the human.
Yeah. 100%. And I think you've hit on something there. It only happens through honest conversation.
Yes.
And then it's about how do we create forums where we can have those honest conversations. And I think they happen in a number of different contexts. So again, our interviews before COVID would always happen in a coffee shop over a coffee, because we just wanted to bring that. We're here, where one of our values is hospitality. We're in the hospitality game. How can we get rid of the formality and already start that? Here we are. I just happen to be on this side of the table, you're on that side of the table, but who are you? In all of our spot checks, so, yes, there's a 104-point checklist of things that people have to answer and be answerable for, but also within that are questions about how are you? What's going on? How's the family? How we want to know by name each other's backdrops, whatever it is that you're bringing to work, we're interested in that as well, because it's all part of you, isn't it? So it's how do we create those forums where people can be honest, particularly in a remote working team? How do you create those coffee pot conversations or whatever it is,
moments of
queuing
connection
for the new moments of connection? That's right.
Have you ever had to make a decision at any point for the good of the business that you felt maybe in hindsight has kind of gone against this sort of human first focus, or do you not think that? Do you look back and say, well, we had to do that because ultimately it was in the best interest of the business?
And we had a massive hiatus in our business post COVID, when the cost of living kicked in, where 50% of our team left, and that was a massive shock for me, because I believed that we had built a culture that was strong and enduring.
Do you know what caused that?
I think one, the panic around cost of living. So people that are on the breadline. At that point, we were one of the highest paying companies in the UK. And then post Brexit, where trying to find people was really tough for industries like ours. It became the Wild West. So people were... people have raised the pay rate by up to £5 an hour in some cases. It's just unheard of. But I knew that that wasn't going to be long-term sustainable for the business or for the economy. With the cost of living narrative, the person paying was a client. Well, everyone was in that boat together.
Of course,
So to trying to explain to the team and take them on that journey, I think I got that wrong. Mm. I think I left it too late. I think I made assumptions about how trusting the team might be, right, given the relationship history that we'd got that had been strong. I learned a lot about how to hold a couple of lines, really. One, how to bring people along on a journey that might be tough, a journey where everyone may have to sacrifice initially for the good of the company. Two, I think that's the first time I started to understand I've got to hold two things in tension, because if the company doesn't thrive, nobody thrives.
Yeah.
And that's mm-hmm. the first time I had to think about that, because I'm all about the individual. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of the greater good term is now part of my narrative, and that feels challenging, but mm-hmm. there's a tension to hold both of those two things together. And I think my overarching mantra now is, there are tough decisions that you have to make as a leader in a business, as a leader in general. Mm-hmm. For me, if our company goes under, I believe that the work we're trying to do is such a great piece of work, can be so influential, not just for the people in our company, but for the industry as a whole,
yeah.
that it's better that we're there imperfectly trying to right. do the right thing than perfectly or striving for something that maybe I can't achieve and we go under and fold. So that's what we're working through at the moment. We're in a new reality working through that currently.
I am a huge champion of perfect is the enemy of the good. That is my sort of mantra. But certainly in a situation where you have to maintain a constant balance, right? That makes it all the more resonant. Do you find that there's a ripple effect in the work? So do you see the quality of the work that's actually being done on the ground as being better as a consequence of you providing an environment where people feel like their whole self is able to be brought to work?
Pre-COVID, 100%. Mm-hmm. Our client satisfaction scores were out the ballpark. Post-COVID, so I know we're 5 years down the line, mm-hmm. but actually what we realized is that for 2 or 3 years, when we took everything virtual, something broke.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're having to really almost go right back to the beginning and work out, but one, understand that deep relationship can't just exist virtually, mm-hmm. And particularly in challenging work like ours. Yeah. And so we're having to relook at how do we get that balance of using tech for good, but also digging deep into the human aspect of individuals, because actually I'm a great believer in my personal life that good things happen over a meal. So how do we create at those moments of intersection that then build deep and enduring relationship? Because when you've got that buy-in, then absolutely quality goes up, because we're working for the family business then, mm-hmm. not just as a siloed entity out there that no one cares for. When people feel cared for and supported, they're likely to be like your early first responders. They see the problems on the horizon and will report that in. We get all sorts of rich information that comes back when people feel part of the vision, things about what's shifting and changing for clients, which then enable us, things like my client's pregnant, then that enables us in the back office to support that and get ahead of that and send a card or flowers, mm-hmm. be ready for information like that. Mm-hmm. You know, my client's dog died, to be able to, as a team, to think, well, how can we respond to that? Mm. How do we, when their comms come in, where they haven't mentioned that at all, how can we go back and say, because our client is also part of the community, right? So we see you, we've heard you, is there anything else we can do?
Mm.
But without our team on the ground, being those first responders and giving that rich information, we're flying blind. And that happens when they've caught the vision and they feel part of it, and they know that we will support that and amplify what's going on for them on the ground, or support them in what's going on the ground.
I really like some of the language you use, because we all call people who clean houses cleaners, right? And you use things like helpers and first responders. And it really does, that those words are powerful, I would imagine, in sort of shifting people's identities around what they're doing. Have you found that?
I hope so. So again, as I said, we're in a new reality where we're having to explore this. We've literally got an admin team meeting on Friday, and unbeknownst to my team, be fine because this'll land after our team meeting. But I've been asking all of the helpers to send in a video about what motivates them in their role and what could we do better to help support them. And it's, yeah, I think I'm relearning all sorts of things all over again as I have the privilege of watching these messages come through.
When in your work in the human trafficking world, I would assume, because you were working with people who are really sort of, I would imagine, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but sort of stripped back to the real sort of having to, in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, we're really talking about the sort of bottom of that, of that hierarchy, right? What have you learned about human dignity and about what people need in order to thrive that you've then brought into the business and your other work?
And I think it's a really great question, because I think that it was seeing that that made me understand these people who are perceived to be bottom of the pile in the world of society. So let me restart that. In terms of the anti-trafficking, people land in those situations because they are living in desperate situations. Right. Generally, poverty is one of the biggest things that springboard people into a vulnerable experience. So poor pay, poor infrastructure where exploitation is allowed to happen. And then just not being treated in a dignified way creates a vulnerability in someone. And then in that situation, one tiny shift, which could be as simple as someone getting married, which is a really brilliant thing to happen in a family, that could bankrupt an entire family and suddenly they're vulnerable because there's no margins, let alone someone getting sick or someone just going through depression, which is so common for the majority of us. But there's just no room for any of that because they've got to stay on this hamster wheel of earning the money to pay the bills. And the knock-on effect generationally with that is challenging as well, because they're rarely there to raise their children or be part of the community or kick back and sit around the table and eat a meal with other members in their community because they're just having to work all the time. So I'm cleaner number one in our company, but when cleaner number two came along, helper number two, I suddenly realized, well, if I'm prepared to go and clean for, I think it was £10 an hour at that point, and that feels tight to me, I can't expect anyone to do less. That just about pays my bills if I can work X number of hours. So it has to be the same for the next person. And if it isn't, then I understand fully that if I push them into a place of poverty, say working poverty, then they will be vulnerable to being trafficked, and I've trafficked, exploited in some way, and I have seen where that ends up.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the backdrop that helped me just to organically start in the right way.
Yeah. Set up the whole framework for everything that you've then done. And like you said, it's almost creating that psychological safety to be able to bring them their whole selves to work and speak freely, all of those things. Yeah.
When it really speaks to the value of things like universal basic income, the conversations that are happening around that in terms of where work's going to go with AI and things like that. Are we going to get to a point where we need to have something like that? Because just providing people with that scaffolding to survive, it doesn't need to be everything, but it needs to be something that gives them that platform, right? And prevents them from falling beneath that line that then exploits them and puts them in vulnerable positions, as you said. I think it really does. In the whole kind of context of work is obviously about getting paid at its very basic level. And I think it's easy to forget that, especially when in our world where we're talking about work as a deliverer of purpose and meaning and all these things, that actually fundamentally, if we don't get those things right, we might as well not bother, right?
100%. Back to Maslow's basic tenet. You know, we need shelter and food and security and safety. So until we have those, we can't get to that self-actualization pinnacle. So yes, we have a mandate as employers to ensure that those basic needs are being met. Otherwise, how can we ask people to start innovating in our business and adding, you know, purpose and value and all the other things if they're going home hungry or their kids can't afford a pair of shoes to go to school?
Yeah, I mean, something else that's going up the list of important things for employees, broadly speaking. So we're probably talking about more income secure people, generally speaking. But is flexibility. So I just read a stat to Dan today that people are now prioritizing flexibility over pay because it's so vital to the way that we live now and the way that we manage our lives and interact with our families and contribute to our communities and so on and so forth. Is that something that is really important for you to, I mean, it's fundamental to cleaning, I assume, is some aspect of flexibility. Is that something that is important to you as a provider of employment, that you're able to provide that to people as well?
Yeah, as much as possible. And the majority of people in the cleaning industry at a sort of domestic level are women. I think it's something like 67% of cleaners are women. And in London, that's slightly higher. And in London, 55% are migrants of some sort. And so people are juggling, and women in particular, women are typically main carers of children, home, and they need work that can enable them to do all of those things to help them live their outside of work life. The same with my admin team. So currently, that's not always been the case. Currently, all of my admin team are women. And again, one of the things that we look at from the get-go is how can we support you with the family commitments that you've got? Not all of us have children. We've been known to have children at interviews just because, why not? Yeah. if that's going to enable that woman to rock up, have an interview and be our core candidate, then why not? So yes, as far as we can, we would advocate for flexibility. There are some roles, so actually the admin team are probably the hardest, because there are set hours that we need to be there to do the job, but only the roles that do that. And even then, every 2 years we talk about, is this still appropriate that we work from home, or would you prefer that we work in an office? So we've had offices at some point because people are like, my kids have gone to school, I just need to get out and go and see another human being. Right, we'll hire an office. But with the team that we've got right now, they're all younger children, and they all want to be at home so they can do the school run and be there and knit in and out between calls. So yes, as much as possible, we believe in flexibility.
Do you think that some leaders are underestimating the emotional and like relationship side of work? It's such a strange time at the moment in the macro world.
I don't know how well I could answer that, because more and more now I just try and hang around with business leaders that think and act and feel like me.
That's so fair.
So in the circles that I swim in, we fully understand that this is the new way to do good business.
I love that. And that's truly knowing your values and your purpose, right? Actually, and the choice of people that you want to work with and work for. But actually, now that you mentioned earlier, something didn't align. You're like, no, that's not for us in terms of a client relationship. I love that.
Do you feel your clients are on board with this? Are they happy paying a little bit more, knowing that they're doing something positive for society, or is it a struggle, or is it so commoditized that actually the conversation's not happening enough?
No, I mean, we lead with that through our sales visits and all our comms that come through. So the majority of clients that sign on with us understand the bigger picture as well. Obviously, we've got to deliver an excellent service as well. So that's the basic. They're paying for a service. We've got to make sure it's good. But the majority of our clients understand that. There are some clients, and we spot them early on, because they'll start to say things like, you're so expensive, and for this level of money, we're expecting Superwoman. So in those, we try and coach them back around to, no, this is the right cost for cleaning. Every company should be charging this so that every helper can walk away with a decent wage. And you are still employing a human being that sometimes has a tough day at work. And we're here to figure out how can we get that fixed? How can we support them with training? And yes, discipline if need be, but you do start to see those that are sold out completely, and every year when we raise a price because the living wage has risen, you'll get clients that write and say, thank you for managing that, that's brilliant, so happy to pay that. And then you'll get those that drop off, or those that grumble. And again, in our monthly meetings as an admin team, we'll start to talk about, are they still the right client for us? Yeah, so we're revealing some of our back end secrets here. But
I mean, so Dan and I are marketing people. And so my mind goes right away to, are you engaging your clients with the kind of storytelling aspect of the business? Or are you sharing some of those experiences of the individuals who are working for them and giving them a little bit of that view in? Does that help?
Not enough.
Okay.
Not enough. And again, because our margins are so tight, so we've had a marketer on board with us for a couple of years. But recently we parted ways, we paused. So that was one of her big drums. But when it's all down to me and I'm spinning all the plates, not enough story to
trust me. But you're preaching to the choir over here. Trying to get this podcast to market it is just, it's just above and beyond.
With all the other things that really do need to happen.
Exactly.
If there's someone listening to this, just going back to your point earlier, where you said, I was a PE teacher, but now I'm this. And if somebody's listening to this thinking, I need to change the tone and language, the way I'm about to talk about myself, where I'm a cleaner or whatever, how would you coach them on that? Because you've done it and you've done it so well. What advice would you give them?
I think number one, there's internal work to be done, which is around everyone has equal value on this planet. So I can use a faith analogy. The Bible talks about the church as a body. And says that every single part of the body is needed in order for the whole to function. And then it mentions things like if a little toe was missing, the whole body would fall over because that's managing the balance. Or if some of this sort of, the spleen or all of those things have functionality and purpose in the body. And that's us as humans. We need each other in order to thrive, and everyone has a skill that's worthy to bring to the table. So number one, kind of figure out what were you made to do? Mm-hmm. Cleaning is a glorious thing. So it's one of the most liberating jobs I had for a while there. That absolute joy of leaving something pristine for another human being, like at 9 o'clock at night, I'd lay down and I think, oh, right, about now they're going to discover that little fold.
And it's so tangible, right? You can see it right
instant.
In front of you. Yeah.
It's instant gratification for you, instant gratification for that person walking through the door, smelling the smells, seeing the sights. So everything has worth on this earth. And one, you've got to do a bit of the work to understand that you bring value to any situation. What's your superpower? Mm. Yeah. Whatever it is, that is valid. One. Then it presses into knowing your worth. So it's about, when I coach, I've got one of my blocks, which is like actively walk away from the naysayers. So if there are people in your life that are really trying to put you down or tear down what you're trying to build, and yourself, you're trying to build yourself in and amongst that, they need to walk away. They're not your people. They're not going to help you thrive. Find your tribe. Find the people that get who you are and celebrate and support that. Mm-hmm. Three, just really understanding that as humans, to thrive, we need to be interdependent, not independent. Mm-hmm. And you have a role to play in that. You are needed to help the person next to you thrive. So for my cleaning team, for our helpers, as you said, the tangible joy and relief that gives to clients as they walk through the door at the end of a cleaning day frees them up to read a bedtime story to their child, which enables their child to have that sense of mum and dad, mum or dad were there, which gives them a baseline of confidence to grow up and go out into the world and to thrive and to contribute and on and on and on and on. And that's just because you mopped a floor with sensitivity, you thought about the placement of their pots and pans, you learnt that they like to have their cup of tea coaster at this angle next to their bed, you ease the way for them to just get rid of some of the things that are cluttering their mind so that they can thrive and be free to do their thing, so that whoever they're enabling and so on and so on and so on, we all knock on to each other. And it doesn't matter where you are in that, whether you're perceived as a small cog or a big cog, every cog is essential. So,
it's a great way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly, when I come home and my house is clean, it's like it has a nervous system effect.
I know within minutes when the kids torn, nothing quite has over. That,
yeah.
But I always, whenever I come home and I just soak it up, I go, yeah.
It's so nice.
For a hot minute, it's tidy and it releases some sort of joy, relaxation, all those things. I honestly was welled up then when you were saying that. Mm. You bottled that, what you've just said. And it was moving.
So what's next for you and your business?
Actually, one, back to the drawing board. So we're dismantling everything. We're trying to figure out how do we get back to pre-COVID with everything that we've learned since COVID? How do we get back to being a thriving community that is interdependent and works well together? Mm-hmm. How do we, so we're working on that. And we've spent 2 years working on quality, 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 banging that drum, getting back to let's just rock up and clean well. Let's rock up and type good emails, all of the things. Now we're into our community phase. How do we rebuild community so that it works for everybody? Once we've semi-solved that, pre-COVID, we were at that point of thinking, can we expand? Can we franchise or can we replicate? I'm still sitting on the fence on that. But my big vision, the thing that I think I'm born to do is to make change. So to campaign for change. Change that doesn't just affect our business, but affects every cleaning business in the UK. So for me, I want to change the VAT laws for cleaning across the UK. My belief is because we sit in a 20% VAT bracket, it's creating challenging employment structures.
Yeah.
Certainly a gnarly problem for us, which then creates a load of cash in hand practices,
right.
Which then creates exploitation of vulnerability for the worker, but also for the client. And I believe for the public purse, I think because we're not taxing well, we're actually not getting as much in the tax coffers as we could. So that's the message that I want to take to Parliament. If you just lower the VAT bracket, I think you'll find that there'll be more money from the cleaning sector in the public purse. And what can we do with that? But my real aim, of course, is that I want every cleaner in the UK to be paid at least the real living wage, if not above. So that's what I'm trying to do, which some nights at 2 a.m. feels a little bit stupid and large, but there you go. It's how I'm hardwired. So on I go. Then we'll see I'm giving us 3 years to kind of get back to where we were culture wise, and then review what comes next for us as a business. Do we replicate? Do we sell and press into campaigning arm? I don't know. I've still got other dreams that are going on. Like my ultimate dream is to create a foundation that is a grant-making foundation for sparky kids exiting the care system, kids that have maybe got some entrepreneurial spark, which would then tie everything together, I think, in my mind. Because for me, if I could start a business with £10 in my pocket and take it to over £1 million enterprise, I think that there's something in that kids that are maybe disenfranchised through the school the school system. So how do we put in mentoring and all of those things? But I digress. That's
I mean, it's not far from our conversations, because obviously every time we talk about work, we end up talking about education and how that then prepares kids, or should it even prepare kids for work? You know, what is its fundamental service in society? What does it provide? So there's a
massive conversation.
That's a whole series in itself.
Yes, exactly. Which is why today we were recording our second Education is Weird Now episode, because there is
kind of
so
primary
much to,
setting kids up, you know, or is it too far away? Should it be all those things? So
how exciting.
Yeah.
And so essential.
Yes, exactly. So like you, we just keep adding things to our list of to-dos. So great. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to learn more?
Because of my name, if you type in Antoinette Daniel, I'm probably top of Google. So I've got a webpage. If you land on that, then all the ways to contact me are in there. So LinkedIn is the place that I hang out the most. But yes, if you send in a form, I'm generally up for a coffee, virtual or in person, with people. I'm curious about people. So reach out. I'd love to continue this conversation. Yeah.
Great.
Thank you so much
for being here. Thanks for making the trip to our studio London here.
Yeah. What an inspiration you are. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.